Let's turn to Psalm 5 now, and we'll read the whole psalm. Psalm 5. To the chief musician, with flutes, a psalm of David. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Give heed to the voice of my cry, my King and my God. For to you I will pray. My voice you shall hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning I will direct it to you, and I will look up. For you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand in your sight. You hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But as for me, I will come into your house in the multitude of your mercy. In fear of you, I will worship toward your holy temple. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness, because of my enemies. Make your way straight before my face, for there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is destruction. Their throat is an open tomb. They flatter with their tongue. Pronounce them guilty, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions, for they have rebelled against you. But let all those rejoice who put their trust in you. Let them ever shout for joy, because you defend them. Let those also who love your name be joyful in you. For you, O Lord, will bless the righteous with favor. You will surround him as with a shield. This text has the feel of a courtroom or of legal proceedings. You have David coming to God with his plea, giving reasons that he should hear him, reasons that God should choose in his favor. If I can remember a time in high school, I got in trouble. And I didn't just have to go to the principal's office. I had the principal there, I had a teacher there, a couple coaches, and I was guilty before them. I was caught red-handed. I had no plea of innocence. It was obvious that I was guilty. And I sat there with my head hung low. I couldn't argue at all. There was shame. You might have had this. Maybe you've got a speeding ticket or something. Maybe on camera. There's no plea of innocence of your vehicle. Maybe you can even see your head in the back window. The license plate is you. There's no arguing it. Or maybe you've had this in front of your parents as well. You've come to your parents, and it's they know what you've done. You can't say anything. You just have your head hung low. Well, this is not the picture we get of David as he's coming before God. He's coming before God, and he's bold. He's got his head high, and he's saying, God, listen to me. He's got his case against his enemies. He's saying, they are guilty. Pronounce them guilty. He's prepared before his God, and he's accusing the guilty party. And he's confident. And the psalm defines two parties. There's those who can come before God, and there's those who cannot come before God. There's David coming before God and saying, these people cannot come before you, God. What I hope you see this morning is that we can only come to a holy God hiding behind his steadfast love toward us. We're going to look at this in three different parts. First, we want to look at those who can come before God. And then we're going to look at those who cannot come before God. And then we're going to look at kind of why it matters. Why it matters that we can come before our God. And we're going to start in the middle of this psalm. We're going to work our way out. So if you notice, the psalm is divided up into five sections. You'll see little spaces in there. And we're going to start in the middle section. So the verses 4, 5, and 6. We're going to start in that section. We're going to start in verse 7 and 8. And then we're going to work our way out. So there's five sections. There's the beginning and the last. And then there's two on the inside, and there's one right in the middle. And we're going to start one right in the middle. So this psalm has that courtroom back and forth through these five sections. The first section, God hear me, that's verse 3. And then you have the last 11 and 12 verse of the fifth section there. It's God protect me. And then we have the second section that you will not hear the wicked. And that's paired with the second last paragraph of destroy the wicked. And then you have that last the middle section where it's, we come before God based on his steadfast love. So you see, David is pleading in front of a judge here against his enemies. These enemies have lied, they've deceived, and David comes to God and says, I'm yours, they are not, hear me, don't hear them, cast them out even, and protect me. That's what David is saying here. So before we get into our first point, we have to, who is David referring to here? These are pretty heavy charges. It's not just a slap on the wrist or a $100 fine. David's asking that these people be cast out, that they be destroyed. Who is David referring to here? So some claim that David wrote this when Absalom, his son, was trying to take over the throne, take over Jerusalem. And this could be likely since Absalom, his son, used lies, he used deception to steal the throne from David. But as with many Psalms, the context isn't 100% sure. But this very well could be the case of Absalom. It fits. And it can be helpful to look at it from that perspective. If you remember the story of Absalom in 2 Samuel 14 and 15, he was the son of David, and he tried to take over the throne. He basically did get the throne from David for a short amount of time. David had to flee from Jerusalem. But Absalom sat at the city gates, and when people came to speak to David, he would get them first and say, "Oh, David doesn't have time to hear you." When he was lying, he was using lies, pure lies and deception to fool the Israelites into thinking that David was a poor leader. And it enabled him to take the throne for a short amount of time. And David fled from Jerusalem. And it's thought that David wrote this psalm as he fled or as he was out of Jerusalem. But the point is that David has been harmed by evil men. And he's seeking help. And I'm sure we can all identify with situations like this. Maybe someone wasn't trying to take your throne, as in someone's trying to take David's throne from him, but maybe you've been in difficult relationships that you have been lied about, deceived, you've been hurt. It's not hard to imagine that. This happens in a lot of relationships within families, between husband and wife, children, between children, parents and children, at work. People take the credit where you deserve the credit. It happens a lot. I'm sure we can identify with that. Well, as we think of times when we have wrongfully been accused, we have David laying out, who can bring their case, their plea to the Lord, and who cannot. Remember, we are starting in the middle, in verse 7 and 8, and we're going to work our way out from there. Well, verse 7 says, "But I, through the abundance of your steadfast love, will enter your house. I will bow down toward your holy temple in the fear of you." See, David is able to enter before the Lord. If you're like me, you think, David. David is the man after God's own heart. He's the chosen king of Israel. Of course he can come before God, right? Or maybe you think, on the other hand, David is the guy who lied, killed Uriah. How could he come before God? But maybe if we fall into either of those, we kind of get the wrong perspective. See, it's not the character of somebody who enables them to come before God. It's the character of God who enables us to come before Him. It's the type of God. David says, "Through the abundance of your steadfast love, I will enter." It's not through his military defeats or his accumulation of wealth that he enters. It's quite the opposite. David wasn't allowed to build the temple because he was a man who shed blood, a man of war, we hear in 1 Chronicles 28. But here in verse 7, he says he longs for the temple. David longed for the temple. And he is expressing that longing, that desire. But he's expressing that confidence that he will enter into God's presence because of God's abundant, steadfast love. You see, in Leviticus 2, we read of who could enter into God's house. Who could enter into the Holy of Holies in the temple? Well, God stipulates who could enter. And what they had to do to come in. See, only the high priest could come in once a year. And he had to be ceremonially clean, which entailed a whole bunch of things. It was a complicated procedure. The point is that coming into God's presence was not something to be taken lightly. The image drawn is that no one was simply able to come before God. There was a big process. He had to do a lot of things. The high priest had to perform a sacrifice for himself before he could even go in there to perform a sacrifice for others. Going into God's presence is a big deal. Not just anyone could do it. Unless they were sinless. Unless they were perfect. And then it was very simple. If they were simple, or if they were sinless, it was very simple. And of course, the only one that can do that was Christ, our Savior. Everyone else has sin on them. But David here says, "I will enter your house because you are an always loving God." You see, we can come to God because His abundant, steadfast love has been poured on us through Jesus Christ. You see, it's that simple. God is love, right? Well, I mean, that's the center of the gospel. For God so loved the world that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever comes before Him has eternal life. See, that's our confidence. Not in ourselves, but in the love of another. And some would like to leave it off there. Loving God, that's all we need. But this brings us to our second point. We don't just have rainbows and gumdrops in this psalm. If we view God's love apart from His absolute abhorrence with sin, we lose God's justice. So to really understand what God's abounding, steadfast love means, we have to go into who cannot enter into God's presence. So we're now going one step out from the middle. We're looking at verses 4 through 6 and then verses 9 through 10 as our point 2. So we look at verse 4 through 6. David tells us of God's character compared to wickedness. He says, evil may not dwell with you. You hate all evildoers. You destroy those who speak lies. The Lord abhors bloodthirsty and deceitful man. Verses 9 and 10. Make them bear their guilt. Let them fall by their own counsels. Cast them out. Maybe you don't like these verses. Maybe you're kind of want to avoid them. But when that happens, David's plea for help, what happens to that? What happens to, well, David's being harmed, he's being deceived, being lied about. What happens to that if we avoid these verses? See, we have these two sides. God's love and God's hatred for sin. And they're sometimes played against each other. But we don't have to. If we look at, well, we look at Genesis 18, God talks to Abraham. It's about the Sodom and Gomorrah, right? God talks to Abraham and says, because of the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to their outcry that has come up to me. See, there's a cry from the oppressed in the city. If God doesn't answer that cry, then, well, He's not loving. But God is loving. So He answers the oppressed, answers their cry, and He actually destroys the oppressors, which ends up being the whole cities. But God stops the oppression because He is a loving God. Maybe a less serious case. My kids get ice cream out, and one takes all the ice cream. There's none left. For me to be just, for me to be loving, would be to take ice cream from the one and give it to the other. But I'm taking it from one, right? That is what love is. It's being just, being fair. So we have David coming to God and bringing his grievance. David saying, I can come to you. And the ones that are lying about me, the ones that are hurting me, they cannot come to you. And David defines God's character. David is laying out his case. He's saying, listen to me, don't listen to them. Because, verse 4, you are God who does not delight in wickedness. And the ones that are, I'm complaining about, David says, they're wicked. You are God who cannot even be present with evil. And these men are evil, David says. You know those people that they kind of get under your skin, you just get annoyed by them, you have to bite your tongue when you're around them. Well, God doesn't just get annoyed by evildoers. It's not as though they're just hanging around Him and He just gets really irritated. God is so holy that evildoers literally cannot even be in His presence. Physically, God casts them out. The Hebrew has the sense of guests, saying God can't even have evildoers as guests. Verse 6, God will destroy those who speak lies. The Lord abhors bloodthirsty and deceitful man. This is why they cannot be in His presence, because He'll destroy them. They won't even survive. David is saying, listen to my plea. You are a God who hates evil and those doing evil. David's saying, this is the kind of God I know you are. So I know you will hear me. Because the ones lying about me, the ones trying to hurt me, they're wicked in your sight. But you know what David is doing here? Remember, it's kind of a court case. He's bringing his case. He's setting up his enemies and saying, God, these are not just my enemies. They are your enemies too. Look how wicked they are. These are the ones that are not allowed into God's presence. David recalled God's character in verse 4 through 6, and now he's saying these men are those type of people. Look at who they are. There is no truth in their mouth. Their inmost self is destruction. Their throat is an open grave. They flatter with their tongue. David's pointing out to God that these men are the kind of men you don't allow into your house. Actually, as we think of this psalm as a sort of court, David is pleading that God not even hear their case. They're liars. Why should He hear their case? David is revealing their character before God and saying, I am justified. They're not. Hear me, don't hear them. In fact, it goes even further in verse 10. It goes beyond just don't hear them. In verse 10, David says, make them bear their guilt, O God. Let them fall by their counsels. Because of the abundance of their transgressions, cast them out, for they have rebelled against you. Now what do we do here? It's one thing for David to plead for God to hear his case, and that God not hear the case of his enemies. And here we have David calling down judgment on his enemies. That they would be cast out. They fall, they bear their own guilt, the guilt of lying, of bloodshed. Verse 6, God destroy liars. David is asking that they be destroyed. Well, I think we can think of five things as we read these verses, unless we start praying these condemning prayers to everyone who maybe gets in our way. First, we have to remember that this is a prayer. David is in hard times. He's maybe fleeing Jerusalem, fleeing his throne, and he's putting his stress into God's hands. It's not as though he's doing the condemning himself. And this is a good reminder. When you're sinned against, where do you turn? My mind usually goes to payback or vengeance. Make them feel the hurt that I have been hurting. How can I make them feel that? Well, this is a prayer expressing his own pain and hurt. And he's not inflicting pain on others. He's leaving that to God and saying, God, you do this. Second, we have to remember who David is. He is the chosen king of Israel. Those that oppose him are directly opposing God's chosen leader. So it's not as though we can pray this prayer against our personal enemies. I most likely shouldn't pray this condemning prayer on the guy who cut me off on the highway on the way down here yesterday from Ponoka. See, my pride gets in the way. Where David is seeing that he is the king of Israel, his chosen king of Israel. And opposition to him is an opposition directly against God. His enemies are opposing God, and it's not just his lane of traffic that they're opposing. They're opposing God. Well, third, we also have to remember that these are God's enemies. They're opposing God's chosen leader, as we just said. David showed that these men harmed him, but more so that they're harming God. They're offending God. And God should defend his character. If God hates evil, and he is loving, then he will defend David's plea, David's cause. And I think that's where it's hard for us, for me especially. It's really easy to see when I have been offended. It's always so obvious to us. Something, gossip has traveled around, something's traveled around, and you've suffered from it. It's easy to see that you have been harmed. All the people from work have taken your credit. You can identify when you have been harmed, when you have been hurt very easily. But here, David admits his hurt. But where does he turn after that? See, do we take it personally? Do we take that hurt against us? Do we want vengeance? Or do we see this sin as offensive to God? Do we lash out at the injustice done to us or the injustice done to God? If we look at Christ hanging on the cross, the image of injustice, the sin of every one of us on him, when he was totally innocent, he could have looked down as he hung there, could have looked down, seen the nails in his hands and feet, and he could have just said, I don't deserve this. And he didn't. But he stayed there so that when we have been hurt, when we've been lied to, when we have been the recipient of lying, of deception, that we wouldn't have to feel sorry for ourselves, but rather we would see that sin has far greater consequences than just our hurt. Sin had the consequence of nailing the Son of God to a tree and holding him there. As David is sinned against, and as we are sinned against, it can be helpful to see that all sin is offensive to God, that it hurts him because look at what it did to him. It destroyed him. The fourth thing we can remember is that there is evil out there. This language, make them bear their guilt, let them fall by their counsels, cast them out, for they rebelled against you. It has to be there because there is evil. And this is against the evil in the world. I think we can all see the evil in the world. On a daily basis, we experience that. Well, David is showing that the wickedness that he is experiencing, that those wicked people that he is experiencing, that they should be separated from God. They should fall. They should be cast out. That they should be destroyed. Well, does this make you kind of weary? Does it make you scared? Does it make you fearful? And that's exactly what it should do. Because sin separates us from God. This prayer is absolutely justified. There is wickedness out there and it should be separate from God. The wicked should be cast out. Sin is not a light matter. David says, I will bow down toward your holy temple. And what did he say? He says, I will bow down to your holy temple in the fear of you. David realizes this. He realizes the seriousness of this. He's afraid as he comes to God. Remember, we're looking at the two opposing sides. Those included in God's presence and those excluded. David said that he comes to the Lord's temple in the fear of God. Fearfully. Rightfully so. We have this contrast between God's holiness and the wicked. And the consequences are scary. Well, fifthly, we can think of this as a call to flee evil as well. To flee lying, to flee deception. God hates sin so much that he killed his one and only son. That's how detestable it is. That even when sin was on his son, not like Abraham holding the knife over his son, and then God providing a sacrifice, alternative sacrifice. Jesus Christ was that alternative sacrifice that God offered for us. Jesus hung on the cross with our sin, with your sin, with my sin on him, and the Father turned his head away to let him die. But that Jesus hung there is evidence of God's steadfast love. And I pray that you see that more and more clearly as you see God's hate, hatred of sin and of evil. But maybe you stop there, you think David, right? God hates evil, and we think, well, look at David. He's condemning the liar, the bloodthirsty. But David himself lied to Uriah. Here, come back, Uriah. Spend some time with your wife. Have some time off. And then when Uriah proved to be more morally upright than David, David killed him. David is a liar. He's a bloodthirsty man. So with all this that he's saying here, he's condemning himself. If we look at ourselves, we see that we are guilty as well, though. All this sin is on us, too. The Catechism shows us what the commandments of lying, murder really mean. There's no way that we pass God's standard for what we should be doing. So the only hope we have is God's steadfast love. And that's what I am emphasizing. Your only chance is to hide behind God. To hide behind the shield of God and His steadfast love. Left on our own, we would be cast out from God's presence. You wouldn't even be allowed to bring your case, your plea before Him. Well, this brings us to our third point. We're looking at the beginning and the end of the psalm now, verses 1 to 3 and verse 11 and 12, to see why this all matters. Why it matters that David and you and I can only come to the Lord hiding behind His steadfast love. I want to point out two things here. Confidence and joy. Remember, this is set in a courtroom, and you have bad guys, you have liars, bloodthirsty men on the one side, and then you have David on the other. So we have David, the liar, the bloodthirsty man himself, confidently asking God to destroy liars and bloodthirsty men. It reminds me of Romans 3 or Psalm 14. No one is righteous, not even one. How can David be confident in this case? It's like you watch that show, Judge Judy, and you have these two people come before her and they give their case, and you kind of hear both their cases and you're like, neither side is, they're both despicable. Like, how would you choose? How does God choose between these two sides? But you also see that we're placed in there as well. We're standing in that courtroom too. We stand there along with liars, with bloodthirsty men, and we fit right in with them. Romans says, there is no one righteous, not even one who does good. So as we stand there, we ask the question, how can David be confident? Because we want confidence as well. So how can we be confident in a holy God? Well, what gives confidence in a courtroom? I'm not a lawyer, but I've seen lawyer movies, and they probably display the correct view of how courtrooms work, right? Well, lawyers know how the case is going to go before they arrive in the courtroom. They have confidence because they've stayed up countless hours finding all the laws and the facts that are relevant to their case. And they know how the judicial system works. They know the judge. They've prepared. Well, here David knows his judge. He knows the system. Verse 2, David says, my king and my God. My king, my God. So when I'm in the States, I get intimidated by their police. I'm not an American citizen. I'm on a 3-year visa. My visa will expire shortly. So I don't have that confidence that they're going to look after me. Not the same as Canada. When I'm here, it's my country. So I have that confidence that they're looking out for me. I don't know how justified that confidence is, but I have more confidence in my country than in somebody else's country that I'm a visitor in. Well, we say with David, my king and my God. We are God's people. We have a confidence that He will protect us because we are His. Galatians calls us sons of God, not slaves, but sons. You see, David knows his judge. David's confidence also comes from his preparedness. He knows what he has to do. Verse 3, the Hebrew has the context there, the implication that he's bringing a sacrifice to God. That he's laying his sacrifice out, he's prepared, and he's waiting there for God to act. It's implied that he waits with confidence. His sacrifice was according to the requirement laid out in Leviticus, and he waits for an answer. But if David is going to wait on account of what he's prepared, if he's made a sacrifice, he's waiting on account of that, he'd be waiting a long time because, well, that sacrifice pointed to something a long ways in the future. It pointed to the sacrifice. Hebrews 10 says, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. David's sacrifice was based on Christ's sacrifice, on Jesus Christ's sacrifice. You see, the sacrifice of animals, Paul pointed to the greater sacrifice. Hebrews 10:10 says, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. So we have this courtroom, and David is crying out, convict them, let their sin overcome them, let them be destroyed for what they have done to me and for what they have done to you, God. This is all pointing to a sacrifice, right? David is prepared, coming before his God. Then we have Jesus stepping into his place, stepping into the place of sinners as the ultimate sacrifice. It's as though he enters the courtroom as the accused, and he stands in front of David's accusations. David says, the wicked deserve to die. They deserve to be cast out from God. And then what does Jesus do? He gets cast out, and he dies on the cross. And on the cross, as he's dying, he says, Father, well, what does he say? He says, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they do. Jesus said, forgive them, as he died. This is the picture we have of an abundantly steadfast, loving God. Our confidence rests in Jesus Christ. At the point of death and his most suffering, he forgave us. David's prayer is, well, if we think of his psalm as a prayer, right? It's a prayer. David's prayer is answered in two ways. You see, the wicked are judged. Jesus is killed because our sin is put on him and he is killed. He's carrying our sin. But his prayer is also answered. David's prayer is also answered as David is delivered because Jesus is killed. But what does he do as he's being killed? He forgives sinners. As Jesus was saying, forgive them for they know not what they do. It's as if he's talking to David. David does not know what he's asking in this prayer. But David has confidence in his God and King to save him. He just doesn't know the cost yet. Where does this leave you? I pray it leaves you with confidence. Confidence in God to save, because obviously it's not us. But I also pray that you see joy. These last few verses, David says, let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Let them ever sing for joy. Ever sing for joy. Verse 11 says, whoever takes refuge in God rejoices. You see, we have those two ways. Those who can come before God, those who cannot come before God. Included, excluded. Whoever takes refuge in God is included, and they will rejoice. They will ever sing for joy in verse 11. Forever exulting in the Lord who saved them. And this is what we are called to do. It is what we get to call others to do as well, to show others. We have the warning of what life is like apart from God. You see, the Lord hates evildoers. He wants to destroy them. Their mouth is an open grave. Their inmost self is destruction. The psalmist says, let them fall. Cast them out, O God, because they are sinful. Destroy them. This is a warning to you. Don't be like this. Rather, see, we have two options. Don't be like that. Take refuge in God. It's as simple as that. And we can show the joy of hiding in God, of resting in Him. You see, in Christ there's none of this destruction of being cast out. Rather, it's rejoicing and joy forever. What is all this based on? What is all this joy based on? It's based on the steadfast love of God on the cross. Not on anything you have done or will do. It's based on what He has already done. What has already been done. Well, the last verse says, you bless the righteous, O Lord. You cover him with favor as with a shield. We can see the wicked, that they are detestable to God. We can see that life is hard. We experience this. Life is hard. But what do? When we experience the evil of the world, we tuck and hide behind God's shield. I know it's not mowing season, but when I was writing the sermon, it was mowing season. And we have this pine tree in our yard. And these branches stick down. They're all the pointy needles, the long pointy needles, and the branches are just sticking everywhere. And whenever you mow underneath it, the branches go everywhere, right? You have to you don't have arms to hold all the branches back. And you just get poked and prodded, and you're trying to, like, pull them up and get underneath there. And you have the two handles on the front for the riding mower. So it's all open in the front. You're trying to, like, steer it and then turn with the two handles. It's really awkward. But you just get poked and prodded. But I don't mow by myself. My son, he sits on my lap and he mows with me. And he used to try to, like, help me push branches out of the way. My youngest son, Jake, he's only 2 years old, so he's not much help with holding branches out of the way. But he would try to push them out of the way, but it didn't work. But he's learned now that all he has to do, so when he comes to that tree when we're mowing, all he does, he just puts his head down. Just puts his head down like that. And he knows I'll put my arm over him. Which means that I don't have arms to hold the branches back anymore. But I can protect it with that arm. And the branches slide and scrape me instead of him. And that's the picture we have of God. He puts his arms over us, protects us completely, shields us. And all we have to do is put our head down. See, the word shield here is a full body shield. in war, they had shields that would cover your whole body. And that's the picture here. A full body shield completely covering us. And all we have to do is tuck and hide in Him. And this is what Jesus has done for us. He has become that shield. He is our shield. You see, you'll never be in danger because He is that shield that takes all the bashes, all the scrapes, the prods, the pokings. He takes all that with His own body covering you. See, I hope you've seen how much God hates wickedness. Maybe you're wondering what you have to do to be accepted by God, what you have to do to come before Him. We have to believe that God hates sin so much that it took the killing of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, on a cross to be the price of sin, to pay for sin. And all you have to do is, like my son, just tuck, just bend over and be protected by God, our shield. Put your head down, hide behind Him. He is our shield. And you will be able to rejoice forever because His name is the name that protects us. Let's pray.